way over the Orient. Well, I'd not be there to see it. I turned to look in her direction, and she stood up and waved to me, ever so pretty, calling encouragement. I looked at Solomon, his black hair wet with perspiration and his eyes glittering as he ran up to bowl, and I roared, "No, by God!" and cut him square and hard, clean through a ground-floor window. How they cheered as Solomon thundered through the quality seats, the ladies fluttering to let him by, and the men laughing fit to burst. He hurtled through the front door, and as I completed my second run, I turned to see that ominous figure in the red waistcoat. He and his cronies were the only still, silent members of that whole excited assembly. Damn, Solomon. Was he going to take all day finding the bloody ball? I had to run, with my nerve failing again. I lumbered up the pitch, and there was a great howl from the house. Solomon was emerging dishevelled and triumphant as I made the third run. Only another three, and the match was mine. But I couldn't face it. I knew I daren't win. After all, I wasn't any too confident of Elspeth's virtue as it was. One Solomon, more or less, wasn't going to make all that much difference. Better be a cuckold than a disgraced cripple. I had wobbled in intent all through the past half hour, but now I did my level best to hand Solomon the game. I swiped and missed, but my wicket remained intact. I prodded a catch at him, and it fell short. I played a ball to the off, went for a single that I hadn't a hope of getting, and the great oaf, with nothing to do but throw down my wicket for victory, shied wildly wide in his excitement. I stumbled home with the mob yelling delightedly. Solomon 31, Flashy 30. And even little Felix was hopping from one leg to the other as he signalled Solomon to bowl on. There wasn't a whisper around the field now. I waited at the crease, bowels dissolving, as Solomon stood doubled over, regaining his breath, and then picked up the ball. I was settled in my mind now. I'd wait for a straight one and miss it and let myself be bowled out. Would you believe it, his next three balls were as squint as a Jew's conscience. He was dead beat with running, labouring like a cow in milk, and couldn't keep direction at all. I let him go by while the crowd groaned in disappointment, and when his next one looked like going wide altogether, I had to play at it, like it or not. I scrambled across, trying desperately to pull it in his direction, muttering to myself, "If you can't bowl me, for Christ's sake, catch me out, you ham-fisted buttock!" And in my panic I stumbled, took a frantic swipe, and drove the confounded ball miles over his head, high into the air. He turned and raced to get under it, and there was nothing I could do but leg it for the other end, praying to God he'd catch it. It was still in the air when I reached the bowler's crease and turned, running backwards to watch. He was weaving about beneath it with his mouth open, arms outstretched, while the whole field waited breathless. Down it came, down to his waiting hands. He clutched at it, held it, stumbled, fumbled, and to my horror, and a great shriek from the mob, it bounced free. He made a despairing grab, measured his length on the turf, and there was the bloody ball rolling across the grass away from him. "You... oh, you butter-fingered bastard!" I roared, but it was lost in the tumult. I'd regained my crease, having scored one. I was bound to try for the second winning run with Solomon prostrate and the ball 10 yards from him. "Run!" they were yelling. "Run, Flashy!" And poor despairing Flashy couldn't do anything else but obey. The match was in my grasp, and with hundreds watching, I couldn't be seen deliberately ignoring the chance to win it. So I bounded forward again, full of sham eagerness, tripping artistically to give him a chance to reach the ball and run me out. I went down, rolling, and damn me, the brute was still grovelling after his dropped catch. I couldn't lie there forever, so I went plunging on as slowly as possible, like a man exhausted. Even so, I'd reached the bowler's crease before he'd recovered the ball, and now his only chance was to shy the thing a full 30 yards and hit my wicket as I careered back to the batter's end. I knew he had no hope in hell at that distance. All I could do was forge ahead to victory and ruin at the hands of Teague. The crowd were literally dancing as I bore down on the crease. Three more strides would see me home and doomed. And then the ground rose up very gently in front of me. Crowd and wicket vanished from view. The noise died away into a soothing murmur, and I was nestling comfortably against the turf, chewing placidly at the grass, thinking, This is just the thing, a nice, peaceful rest. How extremely pleasant. I was staring up at the sky with Felix in between, peering down anxiously, and behind him Min's beefy face saying, "Get his head up. Give him air. Here, a drink." And a glass rattling against my teeth and the burning taste of brandy in mouth. There was a deuce of a pain in the back of my head and more anxious faces, and I heard Elspeth's voice in distant, shrill inquiry amidst a babble of chatter. What happened?" says I, as they raised me. My legs were like jelly, and Min had to hold me up. "It's all right," cries Felix. "He tried to shy down your wicket, and the ball hit you crack on the back of the skull. Why, you went down like a shot rabbit." "He threw down your wicket, too, afterwards," says Min. "Damn him." I blinked and touched my head. There was a lump growing like a football. Then here was Solomon, panting like a bellows, clasping my hand and crying, "My dear Harry, are you all right? My poor chap, let me see." He was volleying out apologies, and Min was looking at him pretty cool, I noticed, while Felix fidgeted and the assembling mob were gaping at the sensation. "You mean I was out?" says I, trying to collect my wits. "I'm afraid so," cries Solomon. "You see, I was so confused when I shied the ball, I didn't realize it had hit you, saw you lying there and the ball loose. Well, in my excitement, I just ran in and snatched it and broke your wicket. I'm sorry," he repeated, "for of course I'd never have taken advantage if I'd had time to think. It all happened so quickly, you see." He looked round at the others, smiling whimsically. "Why, it was just like our accident in the first innings when Flashy put me out." At that, the chatter broke out, and then Elspeth was all over me, exclaiming about my poor head and calling for salts and hartshorn. I quieted her while I regained my wits and listened to the debate. Min was maintaining stoutly that it wasn't fair, running a chap out when he was half-stunned, and Felix said, "Well, according to the rules, I was fairly out, and anyway the same sort of thing had happened in Solomon's first hand, which was extraordinary when he came to think of it. Min said that was different because I hadn't realized Solomon was crocked, and Felix said, ah, well, that was the point, but Solomon hadn't realized I was crocked either. And Min muttered, "Didn't he, by George?" And if that was the way they played at Eton, he didn't think much of it.
"But who has won?"
demanded Elspeth. "No one," says Felix. "It's a tie. Flashy ran one run, which made the scores level at 31, and was run out before he could finish the second, so the game's drawn."
"And if you remember," says Solomon,
and although his smile was as bland as ever, he couldn't keep the triumphant gleam out of his eye,
"you gave me the tie, which means,"
and he bowed to Elspeth,
"that I shall have the joy of welcoming you, my dear Diana, and your father aboard my vessel for our cruise. I'm truly sorry our game ended as it did, old chap, but I feel entitled to claim my wager."
Oh, he was, indeed, and I knew it. He'd paid me back in my own coin for felling him in the first innings. It was no consolation that I'd done my dirty work a sight more subtly than he had. Not with Elspeth hopping with excitement, clapping her hands, exulting and trying to commiserate with me all at once. "'Tain't cricket," Min mutters to me. "But there's nothing for it. Pay up, look pleasant. That's the damnable thing about being English and playing against foreigners. They ain't gentlemen." I doubt if Solomon heard him. He was too busy beaming with his arm round my shoulders, calling out that there was champagne and oysters in the house and more beer for the groundlings. So he'd won his bet, without winning the match. Well, at least I was clear where Tig was concerned, for... And then the horrid realization struck me at the very moment when I looked up and saw that red waistcoat on the outskirts of the crowd, with the boozy, scowling face above it. He was glaring at me, tight-lipped, shredding what I guessed was a betting slip between his fingers. He nodded at me twice, ominously, turned on his heel and stalked away. Fatigue had lost his bet, too. He'd backed me to lose and Solomon to win, and we'd tied. With all my floundering indecision and bad luck, I'd achieved the worst possible result all round. I'd lost Elspeth to Solomon and his damned crews, for I couldn't oil out of paying now, and I'd cost Teague 1,000 to boot. He'd exposed me for taking his money and set his ruffians after me. Oh, Jesus! And there was the Duke, too, vowing vengeance on me for deflowering his tiger lily. What a bloody pickle!
"Why, are you all right, old fellow?" cries Solomon. "You've gone pale again. Here, help me get him into the shade. Fetch some ice for his head."
"Brandy!" I croaked. "'No, I'm first-rate, just a passing weakness, the bump, and, my old wound, you know. I just need a moment, to recover, collect my thoughts."
Horrid thoughts there were, too. How the deuce was I going to get out of this mess?
And they say cricket's an innocent pastime.
Extract from the diary of Mrs. Flashman, June 1843. "The most famous thing has happened. Darling Harry has consented to come with us on our voyage, and I'm happy beyond all telling. He has even put aside the prospect of his appointment in the Life Guards, and all for me. It was so unexpected. But that is so like my dear hero. For almost as soon as the match was over and Don S. had claimed his prize, H. said very seriously that he had thought the matter over, and while he was reluctant to decline the military advancement that had been offered him, he could not bear to be parted from me. Such proof of his devotion moved me to tears, and I could not forbear to embrace him, which display, I suppose, caused some remark, but I don't care. Don S., of course, was very warm in agreeing that H. should come, once he had satisfied himself that my dear one was quite determined. Don S. is so good, he reminded H. what a single honour he was declining in not going to the Life Guards, and asked was he perfectly certain he wished to come with us, explaining that he would not have H. make any sacrifice on our account. But my darling said, "No, thank ye, I'll come if you don't mind," in that straightforward way of his, rubbing his poor head, and looking so pale, but determined. I was overjoyed and longed to be private with him, so that I might better express my deep gratification at his decision, as well as my undying love. But, alas, that is denied me for the moment, for almost at once H. announced that his decision necessitated his immediate departure for town, where he has many affairs to attend to before we sail. I offered to accompany him, of course, but he wouldn't hear of it, so reluctant is he to interrupt my holiday here. He is the dearest of husbands, so considerate. He explained that his business would take him about a good deal, and he could not say where he would be for a day or so, but would join us at Dover, whence we sail for the mysterious Orient. So he has gone, not even staying to answer an invitation from our dear friend the Duke, to call upon him. I am instructed to say to all inquiries that he has gone away on private business, for, of course, there are always people anxious to see and solicit my darling, so celebrated as he has become. Not only dukes and the like, but quite ordinary mortals as well, who hope to shake his hand, I dare say, and then tell their acquaintances of it afterwards. In the meantime, dear diary, I am left alone, except for the company of Don S., of course, and dear Papa, to anticipate the great adventure which lies before us, and await that joyous reunion with my beloved at Dover, which will be but the prelude, I trust, to our fairy-tale journey into the romantic unknown.
End of extract. G. de R.
It was one thing to decide to go on Solomon's cruise, but quite another to get safe aboard.
I had to spend 10 days lurking in and about London like a gunpowder plotter, starting at my own shadow and keeping an eye skinned for the Duke's pluggers, and Daedalus Teague's. You may think I was over-timid and the danger none so great, but you don't know what people like the Duke were capable of in my young days. They thought they were still in the 18th century, and if you offended them they could have their bullies thrash you, and then trust to their title to keep them clear of the consequences. I was never a reform bill man myself, but there's no doubt the aristocracy needed its comb cutting. In any event, it required no great arithmetic to decide to flee the country for a spell. It was sickening to have to give up the lifeguards, but if Teague spread a scandal about me, it might well force me to resign anyway. You could be an imbecile viscount with a cleft palate and still fit to command in the household brigade, but if they found you were taking a bookie's tin for favours, heaven help you, however famous a soldier you were. So there was nothing for it but to lie doggo until the boat sailed and make one furtive visit to Horse Guards to tip Uncle Pindley the bad news. He quivered with disbelief down the length of his aristocratic spine when I told him.
"Do I apprehend," says he, "that you are refusing an appointment, free of purchase, may I remind you, in the household brigade which has been specially procured for you at Lord Wellington's instance, in order to go junketing abroad with your wife, her extraordinary father, and this person from Threadneedle Street?" He shuddered. "It is nothing short of commercial travelling."
"Can't be helped," says I. "There's no staying in England just now."
"You realize this is tantamount to refusing an honour from the throne itself, that you can never again hope for any similar mark of favour? I know that you are dead to most dictates of decent behaviour and common discretion, but surely even you can see—"
"Damn it, uncle!" cries I. "I've got to go!" He squinted down his long nose.
"You sound almost desperate. Am I right in supposing there will be some scandal if you do not?"
"Yes," says I reluctantly.
"Well, then that is entirely different," cries he. "Why could you not say so at once? I suppose it is some woman or other."
I admitted it and dropped a hint that the Duke of Blank was involved, but that it was all a misunderstanding, and Bindley sniffed again and said he'd never known a time when the quality of the House of Peers was quite so low. He would speak to Wellington, he said, and since it was advisable for the family's credit that I should not be seen to be cutting the painter, he would see if some official colour couldn't be given to my Far Eastern visit. The result was that a day or two later, at the room over the pawn shop where I was hiding out, I got a note instructing me to proceed forthwith to Singapore, there to examine and approve the first consignment of Australian horses which would be arriving next spring for the company's Indian army. Well done, old Bindley. He had his uses. So then it was just a question of skulking down to Dover for the last of the month, which I accomplished, arriving after dark and legging it along a crowded quay with my valise, hoping to God that neither Teague nor the Duke had camped out their ruffians to intercept me. They hadn't, of course, but if I've lived this long, it's because I've always feared the worst and been ready for it. A boat took me out to Solomon's steam brig, and there was a great reunion with my loved ones. Elspeth all over me, clamouring to know where I'd been. She was quite distracted. And old Morrison grunting, "Ah, you've come, at the coo's tail, as usual." A muttering about a thief in the night. Solomon seemed delighted to see me, but I wasn't fooled. He was just masking his displeasure that he wouldn't have a clear run at Elspeth. That quite consoled me to making the voyage. It might be devilish inconvenient in some ways, and I couldn't be quite easy in my mind at venturing east again, but at least I'd have me flighty peace under me eye. Indeed, when I reflected, that was my prime reason for going, and rated even above escaping Teague and the Duke. Looking back from mid-channel, they didn't seem nearly so terrible, and I resigned myself to enjoying the cruise. Why, it might turn out to be quite fun. I'll give it to Solomon, he hadn't lied about the luxury of his brig, the Sulu Queen. She was quite the latest thing in screw vessels, driven by a wheel through her keel, twin-masted for sail, and with her funnel well back, so that the whole forward deck, which was reserved for us, was quite free of the belching smoke which covered the stern with smuts, and left a great black cloud in our wake. Our cabins were under deck, aft, though, out of the reek, and they were tip-top, oak furniture screwed down, Persian carpets, panelled bulkheads with watercolour paintings, a mirrored dressing-table that had Elspeth Clapp in her hands, Chinese curtains, excellent crystal and a well-stocked cellaret, clockwork fans, and a double bed with silk sheets that would have done credit to a New Orleans sporting house. Well, thinks I, this is better than riding the gridiron. That is, travelling on an East India man. We'll be right at home here. The rest of the appointment was to match. The saloon where we dined couldn't have been bettered for grub, liquor, and service. Even old Morrison, who'd been groaning reluctantly, I gathered, ever since he'd agreed to come, had his final doubts settled when they set his first sea meal before him. He was even seen to smile, which I'll bet he hadn't done since he last cut the mill hand's wages. Solomon was a splendid host, with every thought for our comfort. He even spent the first week pottering about the coast while we got our sea legs, and was full of consideration for Elspeth. When she discovered she'd left her toilet water behind, he had her maid landed at Portsmouth to go up to town for some, with instructions to meet us at Plymouth. It was royal treatment, no error, and damn all expense. Only two things raised a prickle with me in all this idyllic luxury. One was the crew. There wasn't a white face among them. When I was helped aboard that first night, it was by two grinning, yellow-faced rascals in reefer jackets and bare feet. I tried them in Hindi, but they just grinned with brown fangs and shook their heads. Solomon explained that they were Malays. He had a few half-caste Arabs aboard as well, who were his engineers and black gang. But no Europeans except the skipper, a surly enough frog with a touch of nigger in his hair, who messed in his cabin, so we never saw him, hardly. I didn't quite care for the all-yellow crew, though. I like to hear a British or Yankee voice in the forecastle. It's reassuring-like. Still, Solomon was a Far East trader and part breed himself, so it was perhaps natural enough. He had him under his heel, too, and they kept well clear of us, except for the chink stewards, who were sleek and silent, and first-rate. The other thing was that the Sulu Queen, while she was fitted like a floating palace, carried 10 guns, which is about as many as a brig will bear. I said it seemed a lot for a pleasure yacht, and Solomon smiled and says, "She's too valuable a vessel to risk in Far Eastern waters, where even the British and Dutch navies can afford little protection, and," bowing to us, "she carries a precious cargo. Piracy is not unknown in the islands, you know, and while its victims are usually defenseless native craft, well, I believe in being over-cautious."
"You mean there's danger?"
goggled Morrison.
"Not," says Solomon, "with 10 guns aboard."
And to settle old Morrison's qualms and show off to Elspeth, he had all 40 of his crew perform a gun practice for our benefit. They were handy, all right, scampering about the white scrub deck in their tunics and short breeches, running out the pieces and ramming home, cold shot, to the squeal of the Arab bosun's pipe, precise as guardsmen, and afterwards standing stock still by their guns like so many yellow idols. Then they performed cutlass drill and arms drill, moving like clockwork, and I had to admit that trained troops couldn't have shaped better. What with her speed and handiness, the Sulu Queen was fit to tackle anything short of a man of war.
"It is merely precaution piled on precaution," says Solomon. "My estates lie on peaceful lanes on the Malay mainland for the most part, and I take care never to venture where I might be blown into less friendly waters. But I believe in being prepared."
And he went on to talk about his iron water tanks and stores of sealed food. I'd still have been happier to see a few white faces and brown whiskers around us. We were three white folk, and Solomon and myself, of course, and we were outward bound, after all. However, these thoughts were soon dispelled in the interest of the voyage. I shan't bore you with descriptions, but I'm bound to say it was the pleasantest cruise of my life, and we never noticed how the weeks slipped by. Solomon had spoken of 3 months to Singapore. In fact, it took us more than twice as long, and we never grudged a minute of it. Through the summer we cruised gently along the French and Spanish coasts, looking in at Brest and Vigo and Lisbon, being entertained lavishly by local gentry, for Solomon seemed to have a genius for easier acquaintance, and then dipping on down the African coast into the warm latitudes. I can look back now and say I've made that run more times than I can count, in everything from an India man to a Middle Passage slaver. But this was not like any common voyage. Why, we picnicked on Moroccan beaches, made excursions to desert ruins beyond Casablanca, were carried on camels with veiled drivers, strolled in Berber marketplaces, watched fire dancers under the massive walls of old Corsair castles, saw wild tribesmen run their horse races, took coffee with turbaned, white-bearded governors, and even bathed in warm blue water, lapping on miles and miles of empty silver sand, with palms nodding in the breeze. And every evening there was the luxury of the Sulu Queen to return to, with its snowy cloths and sparkling silver and crystal, and the delicate chink stewards attending to every want in the cool dimness of the saloon. Well, I've been a crown prince once in my wanderings, but I've never seen the like of that voyage.
"It is a fairy tale,"
Elspeth kept exclaiming, and even old Morrison admitted it wasn't half bad. The old bastard became positively mellow, as why shouldn't he, waited on hand and foot, with two slant-eyed and muscular yellow devils to carry him ashore and bear him in a palki on our excursions. "It's doing me good," says he. "I can feel the benefit." And Elspeth would sigh dreamily while they fanned her in the shade, and Solomon would smile and beckon the steward to put more ice in the glasses. Oh, I even had a patent ice house stowed away somewhere down by the keel. Farther south, along the jungly and desert coasts, there was no lack of entertainment. A cruise up a forest river in the ship's launch, with Elspeth wide-eyed at the sight of crocodiles, which made her shudder deliciously, or laughing at the antics of monkeys and marvelling at the brilliance of foliage and bird life.
"Did I not tell you, Diana, how splendid it would be?" Solomon would say, and Elspeth would exclaim rapturously,
"Oh, you did, but this is quite beyond imagination."
Or there would be flying fish and porpoises, and once we were round the Cape, where we spent a week, dining out ashore and attending a ball at the governor's, which pleased Elspeth no end, there was the real deep blue sea of the Indian Ocean, and more marvels for my insatiable relatives. We began the long haul across to India in perfect weather, and at night Solomon would fetch his guitar and sing Dago dirges in the dusk, with Elspeth drowsing on a daybed by the rail, while Morrison cheated me at ecarte. Or we would play whist, or just laze the time contentedly away. It was tame stuff, if you like, but I put up with it, and kept my eye on Solomon. But there was no doubt about it, he changed as the voyage progressed. He took the sun pretty strong, and was soon the brownest thing aboard. But in other ways, too, I was reminded that he was at least half Dago or native. Instead of the customary shirt sleeves and trousers, he took to wearing a tunic and sarong, saying jokingly that it was the proper tropical style. Next, it was bare feet, And once, when the crew was shark-fishing, Solomon took a hand at hauling in the huge, threshing monster. If you'd seen him, stripped to the waist, his great bronze body dripping with sweat, yelling as he heaved on the line and jabbering orders to his men in coast lingo, well, you'd have wondered if it was the same chap who'd been bowling slow lobs at Canterbury or talking city prices over the port. Afterwards, when he came to sit on the deck for an iced soda, I noticed Elspeth glancing at his splendid shoulders in a lazy sort of way, and the glitter in his dark eyes as he swept back his moist black hair and smiled at her. He'd been the perfect family friend for months, mind you, never so much as a fondling paw out of place, and I thought, hello, he's looking damn dashing and romantic these days. To make it worse, he'd started growing a chin beard, a sort of nigger imperial. Elspeth said it gave him quite the corsair touch. So I made a note to Roger her twice that night just to quell these girlish fancies. All this reading Byron ain't good for young women. It was the very next day that we came on deck to see a huge green coastline some miles to port, jungle-clad slopes beyond the beach and mountains behind, and Elspeth cried out to know where it might be. Solomon laughed in an odd way as he came to the rail beside us.
"That's the strangest country, perhaps, in the whole wide world," says he. "The strangest and the most savage and cruel. Few Europeans go there, but I have visited it. It's very rich, you see."
He went on, turning to old Morrison.
"Gums and balsam, sugar and silk, indigo and spices. I believe there is coal and iron also. I have hopes of improving on the little trade I have started there, but they are a wild, terrible people. One has to tread warily and keep an eye on your beached boat."
"Why, Don Solomon," cries Elspeth, "we shall not land there, surely."
"I shall," says he, "but not you. The Sulu Queen will lie well off, out of any possible danger."
"What danger?" says I. "Cannibals in war canoes?" He laughed.
"Not quite. Would you believe it if I told you that the capital of that country contains 50,000 people? Half of them slaves, that it is ruled by a monstrous black queen who dresses in the height of 18th-century fashion, eats with her fingers from a table laden with gold and silver European cutlery, with place cards at each chair and wallpaper showing Napoleon's victories on the wall, and having dined, she will go out to watch robbers being burned alive and Christians crucified, that her bodyguard go almost naked, but with pipe-clayed cartridge belts behind a band playing the British Grenadiers, that her chief pleasures are torture and slaughter. Why, I have seen a ritual execution at which hundreds were buried alive, sawn in half, hurled from—"
"No, Don Solomon, no,"
squeals Elspeth, covering her ears, and old Morrison muttered about respect in the presence of ladies. Now, the Don Solomon of London would never have mentioned such horrors to a lady, and if he had, he'd have been profuse in his apologies. But here he just smiled and shrugged, and passed on to talk of birds and beasts such as were known nowhere else, great coloured spiders in the jungle, fantastic chameleons, and the curious customs of the native courts, which decided guilt or innocence by giving the accused a special drink and seeing whether he spewed or not. The whole place was ruled by such superstitions and crazy laws, he said, and woe betide the outsider who tried to teach him different.
"Odd spot it must be," says I. "What did you say I was called?"
"Madagascar," says he, and looked at me. "You have been in some terrible places, Harry. Well, if you ever chance to be wrecked there—" and he nodded at the green shore, "pray that you have a bullet left for yourself."
He glanced to see that Elspeth was out of earshot.
"The fate of any stranger cast on those shores is too shocking to contemplate. They say the Queen has only two uses for foreign men. First, to subdue them to her will, if you follow me, and afterwards to destroy them by the most fearful tortures she can devise."
"Playful little lady, is she?"
You think I'm joking? My dear chap, she kills between 20,000 and 30,000 human beings each year. She means to exterminate all tribes except her own, you see. When she came to the throne some years ago, she had 25,000 enemies rounded up, forced to kneel all together in one great enclosure, and at a given signal, swish, they were all executed at once. She kept a few thousand over, of course, to hang up, sewed in ox skins until they rotted, or to be boiled or roasted to death, by way of a change. That's Madagascar.
Ah, well, says I, Brighton for me next year, I think. And you're going ashore?
For a few hours. The governor of Tamitave up the coast is a fairly civilized savage. All the ruling class are, including the Queen. Bond Street dresses, as I said, and a piano in the palace. That's a remarkable place, by the way, big as a cathedral and covered entirely by tiny silver bells. God knows what goes on in there.
You've visited it?
I've seen it, but not been to tea, as you might say, but I've talked to those who have been inside it, and who've even seen Queen Ranavalona and lived to tell the tale. European, some of them.
What are they doing there, for God's sake?
The Europeans? Oh, they're slaves.
At the time, of course, I suspected he was drawing the long bow to impress the visitors. But he wasn't. No, every word he'd said about Madagascar was gospel true, and not one-tenth of the truth. I know. I found out myself. But from the sea it looked placid enough. Tamitave was apparently a very large village of yellow wooden buildings set out in orderly rows back from the shore. There was a fairish-sized fort with a great stockade some distance from the town, and a few soldiers drilling outside it. While Haslam was ashore, I examined them through the glass. Big buck niggers in white kilts, with lances and swords, very smart, and moving in time, which is unusual among black troops. They weren't true niggers, though, it seemed to me. When Haslam was rowed out to the ship again, there was an escorting boat with a chap in the stern in what was a fair imitation of our naval rig. Blue frock coat, epaulettes, cocked hat and braid, saluting away like anything. He looked like a Mexican, if anything, with his round, oily, black face. But the rowers were dark brown and woolly-haired, with straight noses and quite fine features. That was the closest I got to the Malagasies just then, and you may come to agree that it was near enough. Solomon seemed well satisfied with whatever business he had done ashore, and by next morning we were far out to sea, with Madagascar forgotten behind us. Now, I said I wouldn't weary you with our voyage, so I shall do no more than mention Ceylon and Madras, which is all they deserve anyway, and take you straight away across the Bengal Bay, past the infernal Andamans, south by the heel of Great Nicobar, and into the steaming straits where the great jellyfishes swim between the mainland of Malaya and the strange jungle island of Sumatra, with its man-monkeys, down to the sea where the sun comes from. And the islands lie ahead of you in a great brilliant chain that runs thousands of miles from the South China Sea to Australia and the far Pacific on the other side of the world. That's the East, the islands, and you may take it from one who has India in his bones. There's no sea so blue, no land so green, and no sun so bright as you'll find beyond Singapore. What was it Solomon had said?
Where it's always morning.
So it was. And in that part of my imagination where I keep the best memories, it always will be. That's one side of it. I wasn't to know then that Singapore was the last jumping-off place from civilization into a world as terrible as it was beautiful, rich and savage and cruel beyond belief. Of land and seas still unexplored, where even the mighty Royal Navy sent only a few questing warships, and the handful of white adventurers who voyaged in survived by the speed of their keels and slept on their guns. It's quiet now, and the law, British and Dutch, runs from Sundar Strait to the Solomons. The coasts are tamed, the last trophy heads in the long houses are ancient and shriveled, and there's hardly a man alive who can say he's heard the war gongs booming as the great robber fleets swept down from the Sulu Sea. Well, I heard 'em, only too clearly. And for all the good I've got to say of the islands, I can tell you that if I'd known on that first voyage what I learned later, I'd have jumped ship at Madras. But I was happily ignorant, and when we slipped in past the green Sugarloaf Islands one fine April morning of 44, and dropped anchor in Singapore Roads, it looked safe enough to me. The bay was alive with shipping, 100 square riggers, if there was one. Huge Indiamen under the gridiron flag. Tall clippers of the southern run, wearing the stars and stripes. British merchantmen by the bucketful. Ships of every nationality. Solomon pointed out the blue-crossed anchors of Russia. The red and gold bars of Spain, the blue and yellow of Sweden, even a gold lion, which he said was Venice. Closer in, the tubby junks and long trading prows were packed so close it seemed you could have walked on them right across the bay, fairly seething with half-naked crews of Malays, Chinese, and every colour from pale yellow to jet black. Deafening us with their high-pitched chatter as Solomon's rowers threaded the launch through to the River Quay. There it was bedlam. All Asia seemed to have congregated on the land in bringing their pungent smells and deafening sounds with them. There were coolies everywhere, in straw hats or dirty turbans, staggering half-naked under bales and boxes. They swarmed on the quays, on the sampans that choked the river, round the warehouses and go-downs, and through them pushed Yankee captains in their short jackets and tall hats, removing their cheroots from their rat-trap jaws only to spit and cuss. Armenian Jews in black coats and long beards, all babbling, British blue jackets in canvas shirts and ducks. Long-moustached Chinese merchants in their round caps, born in palkis. British traders from the Sundars with their pistols on their hips. Leathery clipper men in pilot caps shouting oaths of Liverpool and New York. Planters in wideawakes making play among the niggers with their stout canes. A file of prisoners tramping by in leg irons, with scarlet-coated soldiers herding them and bawling the step. I heard English, Dutch, German, Spanish, and Hindi all in the first minute, and most of the accents of England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, and the American seaboards to boot. God knows what the native tongues were, but they were all being used at full pitch, and after the comparative quiet we'd been used to, it was enough to make you dizzy. The stink was fearful, too. Of course, waterfronts are much the same everywhere once you are away from the river. Out on the Mayfair side of the town, which lay east along Beach Road, it was pleasant. And that was where Solomon had his house, a fine two-story mansion set in an extensive garden facing the sea. We were installed in cool, airy rooms, all complete with fans and screens, legions of Chinese servants to look after us, cold drinks by the gallon, and nothing to do but rest in luxury and recover from the rigours of our voyage, which we did for the next 3 weeks. Old Morrison was all for it. He had gluttonized to such a tune that he'd put on flesh alarmingly, and all he wanted to do was lie down, belching and refreshing his ill nature in a hot climate. Elspeth, on the other hand, must be up and doing at once. She was off almost before she'd changed her shift, carried in a palki by menials, to pay calls on what she called the society people, find out who was who, and squander money in the shops and bazaars. Solomon pointed her in the right directions, made introductions, and then explained apologetically that he had weeks of work to do in his changing house at the quays. After that, he assured us, we would set off on our tour of his possessions, which I gathered lay somewhere on the east coast of the peninsula. So there was I at a loose end, and not before time. I didn't know when I'd been so damnably bored. A cruise of wonders was all very well, but I'd had my belly full of Solomon and his floating mansion with its immaculate appointments, and unvarying luxury, and everything so exactly confoundedly right, and the finest foods and wines coming out of me ears. I was surfeited with perfection, and sick of the sight of old Morrison's ugly mug, and the sound of Elspeth's unwearying, imbecile chatter, and having not a damn thing to do but stuff myself and sleep. I'd not had a scrap of vicious amusement for 6 months, and for me that's a lifetime of going hungry. Well, thinks I, if Singapore, the flesh-pot of the Orient, can't supply my urgent needs and give me enough assorted depravity in 3 weeks to last the long voyage home, there's something amiss. Just let me shave and change my shirt and we'll stand this town on its head. I took a long slant to get my bearings and then plunged in. Slavering. There were 8 cross streets in the Mayfair section where all the fine houses were, and a large upland park below Governor's Hill where society congregated in the evening. And by Jove, wasn't it wild work, though? Why, you might raise your hat to as many as 100 couples in 2 hours. And when you were fagged out with this, there was the frantic debauch of a gig drive along Beach Road to look at the ships, or a dance at the assembly rooms, where a married woman might even polka with you, provided your wife and her husband were on hand. Unmarried ladies didn't waltz, except with each other, the daring little hussies. Then there were dinners at Dutrancoy's Hotel, with discussions afterwards about whether the Raffles Club oughtn't to be revived, and how the building of the new Chinese pauper hospital was progressing, and the price of sugar, and the latest leaderette in the Free Press, and for the wilder spirits a game of pyramids on the hotel billiard table. I played twice and felt soiled at my beastly indulgence. Elspeth was indefatigable, of course, in her pursuit of pleasure, and dragged me to every soiree, ball, and junket that she could find, including church twice each Sunday, and the subscription meetings for the new theatre. And several times we even met Colonel Butterworth, the governor. Well, thinks I, this is Singapore, to be sure, but I'm shot if I can stand this pace for long. Once I asked a likely-looking chap, you could tell he was a rake, he was using pomade, where the less respectable entertainments were to be found, supposing there were any, and he coloured a bit and shuffled and said, "Well, there are the Chinese processions, but not many people would care to be seen looking at them, I dare say. They begin in the, native quarter, you know." "By George," says I, "that's bad. Perhaps we could look at them for just a moment, though. We needn't stay long." He didn't care for it, but it prevailed on him, and we hurried down to the promenade with him muttering that it wasn't at all the thing, and what Penelope would say if she got to hear of it he couldn't imagine. He had me in a fever of excitement, and I was palpitating by the time the procession hove in view, 20 chinks beating gongs and letting off smoke and whistles, and half a dozen urchins dressed in Tartar costumes with umbrellas, all making a hell of a din. "Is that it?" says I. "That's it," says he. "Come along, do, or someone will see us. It's not done, you know, to be seen at these native displays, my dear Flashman." "I'm surprised the authorities allow it," says I, and he said the Free Press was very hot against it. But the Indian processions were even worse, with chaps swinging on poles and carrying torches. And he'd even heard rumours that there were fakers walking on hot coals on the other side of the river. That was what put me on the right track. I'd seen the waterfront, of course, with its great array of commercial buildings and warehouses. But the native town that lay beyond it, on the west bank, had looked pretty seedy and hardly worth exploring. Being desperate by this time, I ventured across one evening, when Elspeth was at some female gathering, and it was like stepping into a brave new world. Beyond the shanties was Chinatown, streets brilliantly lit with lanterns, gaming houses and casinos roaring away on every corner, sideshows and acrobats. Hindu firewalkers, too. My pomaded chum had been right. Pimps accosting you every other step, with promises of their sister, who was, of course, every bit as voluptuous as Queen Victoria. How our sovereign lady became the carnal yardstick for the entire Orient through most of the last century, I've never been able to figure. Possibly they imagined all true Britons lusted after her. And on all sides enough popsy to satisfy an army. Chinese girls with faces like pale dolls at the windows. Tall, graceful cling-tarts from the Coromandel, swaying past and smiling down their long noses. Saucy Malay wenches giggling and beckoning from doorways, popping out their boobies for inspection. It was Vanity Fair come true. But it wouldn't do, of course. Poxed to a turn, most of them. They're all right for the drunken sailors lounging on the verandas who didn't care about being fleeced, and possibly knifed, but I'd have to find better quality than that. I didn't doubt that I would, and quickly, now that I knew where to begin, but for the present I was content to stroll and look about, brushing off the pimps and the more forward whores, and presently walking back to the river bridge. And who should I run slap into but Solomon, coming late from his office? He stopped short at sight of me. "Good God!" says he. "You ain't been in Bazaar Town, surely. My dear chap, if I'd known you wanted to see the sights, I'd have arranged an escort. It ain't the safest place on earth, you know. Not quite your style, either, I'd have thought." Well, he knew better than that, but if he wanted to play innocent, I didn't mind. I said it had been most interesting, like all native towns, and here I was, safe and sound, wasn't I? "Sure enough," says he, laughing and taking my arm. "I was forgetting you've seen quite a bit of local colour in your time. But Singapore's, well, quite a surprising place, even for an old hand. You've heard about our black-faced gangs, I suppose. Chinese, you know. Nothing to do with the Tongs or Huis, who are the secret societies who rule down yonder. But murderous villains, just the same. They've even been coming east of the river lately, I'm told. Burglary, kidnapping, that sort of thing. With their faces blacked in soot. Well, an unarmed white civilian on his own, he's just their meat. If you want to go again," he gave me a quick look and away, "let me know. There are some really fine eating-houses on the north edge of the native town. The rich Chinese go there, and it's much more genteel. The Temple of Heaven's about the best, no sharking or rooking or anything of that kind, and first-class service, good cabarets, native dancing, that order of thing, you know." Now why, I wondered, was Solomon offering to pimp for me? Well, that's what it struck me he was doing. To keep me sinfully amused while he paid court to Elspeth, perhaps? Or just in the way of kindness to steer me to the best brothels in town? I was pondering this when he went on. "Speaking of rich Chinese, you and Elspeth haven't met any yet, I suppose. Now they are the most interesting folk in this settlement altogether. People like Huan Por and Tan Tok Seng. I must arrange that. I'm afraid I've been neglecting you all shockingly. But when one's been away for 3 years, well, there's a great deal to do, as you can guess." He grinned whimsically. "Confess it, you've found our Singapore gaiety just a trifle tedious. Old Butterworth prosing, and Logan and Dice ain't quite hard park style, are they? Never mind, I'll see to it that you visit one of old Wampoa's party. That won't bore, I promise you." And it didn't. Solomon was as good as his word, and 2 nights later Elspeth and I and old Morrison were driven out to Wampoa's estate in a 4-wheel palki. It was a superb place, more like a palace than a house, with the garden brilliant with lanterns, and the man himself bowing us in ceremonially at the door. He was a huge, fat Chinese with a shaven head and a pigtail down to his heels, clad in a black silk robe embroidered with shimmering green and scarlet flowers. Straight from Aladdin, except that he had a schooner of sherry in one paw. It never left him, and it was never empty either.
"Welcome to my miserable and lowly dwelling," says he, doubling over as far as his belly would let him. "That is what the Chinese always say, is it not? In fact, I think my home is perfectly splendid and quite the best in Singapore. But I can truthfully say it has never entertained a more beautiful visitor."
This was to Elspeth, who was gaping round at the magnificence of lacquered panelling, gold-leafed slender columns, jade ornaments, and silk hangings, with which Whampoa's establishment appeared to be stuffed.
"You shall sit beside me at dinner, lovely golden haired lady, and while you exclaim at the luxury of my house, I shall flatter your exquisite beauty. So we shall both be assured of a blissful evening, listening to what delights us most."
Which he did, keeping her entranced beside him, sipping continually at his sherry, while we had a Chinese banquet in a dining room that made Versailles look like a garret. The food was atrocious, as Chinese grub always is. Some of the soups and the creamed walnuts weren't bad, though. But the servants were the most delightful little Chinese girls in tight silk dresses, each of a different colour. Even ancient eggs with seaweed dressing and carrion sauce don't seem so bad when they're offered by a slant-eyed little goer who breathes perfume on you and wriggles in a most entrancing way as she takes your hand in velvet fingers to show you how to manage your chopsticks. Damned if I could get the hang of it at first. It took two of them to show me, one either side. And Elspeth told Whampoa she was sure I'd be much happier with a knife and fork. There were quite a few in the party, apart from us three, and Solomon, Balestia, the American consul, I remember, a jolly Yankee planter with a fund of good stories, and Kachik Moses, a big noise in the Armenian community, who was the decentest Jew I ever met, and struck up an immediate rapport with old Morrison. They got to arguing about interest rates. And when Whampoa joined in, Balestia said he wouldn't rest until he'd made up a story, which began, "There was a Chinaman, a Scotchman, and a Jew," which caused great merriment. It was the cheeriest party I'd struck yet, and no lack of excellent drink. But after a while, Whampoa called a halt, and there was a little cabaret of Chinese songs and plays, which were the worst kind of pantomime drivel, but very pretty costumes and masks. And then two Chinese dancing girls, exquisite little trollops, but clad from head to foot, alas. Afterwards, Whampoa took Elspeth and me on a tour of his amazing house. All the walls were carved screens in ivory and ebony, which must have been hellish draughty, but splendid to look at, and the doors were all oval in shape, with jade handles and gold frames. I reckon 500,000 might have bought the blaze. When we were finished, he presented me with a knife inlaid with mother-of-pearl, in the shape of a miniature scimitar. To prove its edge, he dropped a filmy scrap of muslin on the blade, and it fell in half, sheared through by its own insignificant weight. I've never sharpened it since, and it's as keen as ever after 60 years. To Elspeth, he gave a model jade horse, whose bridle and stirrups were tiny jade chains, all cut out of one solid block. God knows what it was worth. She scampered off to show it to the others, calling on Solomon to admire it, and Whampoa says quietly to me,
"You have known Mr. Solomon Haslam for a long time?"
I said, "A year or so in London," and he nodded his great bald head and turned his Buddha-like face to me.
"He is taking you on a cruise round his plantations, I believe. That will be interesting. I must ask him where they are. I should much like to visit them myself some day."
I said I thought they were on the peninsula, and he nodded gravely and sipped his sherry.
"No doubt they are. He is a man of sufficient shrewdness and enterprise, I think. He does business well."
The sound of Elspeth's laughter sounded from the dining room, and Whampoa's fat yellow face creased in a sudden smile.
"How fortunate you are, Mr. Flashman. I have, in my humble way, which is not at all humble, you understand, a taste for beautiful things, and especially in women.